Welcome to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in northern Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. In the opening interview, Peter Marabil will read from his new mystery, Murder at Cherokee Point. Then cultural anthropologist Tim Paulson guides us deep into the Amazon Basin with his extraordinary oral history, Gentle Savage Still Seeking the End of the Spear. At the end, Fleeta Brown will be here with an audio essay on poet William Stafford. I would like to welcome Tim Paulson to Michigan Writers on the Air. We'll be talking about his book, Gentle Savage Still Seeking the End of the Spear. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you this afternoon.
This is a piece of oral history. Could you sort of explain that to our listeners?
Sure. This is the book focuses on a tribe called the Waurani tribe. They are and have been located for centuries in the eastern jungles of Ecuador, very close to the border, unwritten border, with Peru, which is all deep Amazon jungle. Up until the last half century, they had no written language. It is a linguistic isolate, so there's no other language that's similar to their own as well. But it was in the late, mid-50s, actually, that they had contact with the outside world. Until then, they were in complete isolation, known as the most violent people on Earth, and continue to be known as the most violent people on Earth.
And how did you get involved in this?
Well, my earliest childhood memory was in 1956, when a group of these people speared five American missionaries who tried to make contact with them to death on the beach of the Curaray River deep in the jungle. That became international news. It was in every newspaper, on the radio, on TV. Never thought that I would meet them, but by coincidence or providence, as the case may be, I crossed paths with the son of the man who piloted these men in, who was also killed on the river. I worked with him for about 3 years in a mission effort that he had going on in Florida. But at that point, the tribal elders asked if I would come to work with them independently. And that's what I've been doing since about 2003.
In the first 200 pages of the book, you are mostly retelling the old stories.
Yes.
How did you capture these old stories? How did you finally bring them to print? Because you were starting in a language that was almost unknown. What's the process?
Good question. And even starting back a little bit, how the book came to be ideologically, I have always felt, ever since I met these people, that especially Minkai, who was one of the main players there on the beach that day when they speared the Americans, a tremendous story. He's a natural storyteller anyway, but I felt that he needed to tell this story. And as we've already mentioned, he is still illiterate, has never really learned even Spanish. The language of this tribal people is Wautadedo, which means people talk. And it is a linguistic isolate, nothing even similar. So as we talked about the vision of writing this book, or in the terms that I shared with him of him telling his story, it became a passion of his. He told me he's in his 70s now, and he said, you know, I'm like an old fruit tree whose fruit has largely dropped to the ground. But this story and my vision for my people, and for the youth especially, needs to be told. So it became a question, as you've already implied, of logistics. I don't speak enough Wautadedo to have done this directly from Wautadedo to English. So I had two of his friends who were also there on the beach the day that the missionaries were speared were there to help tell the story. He was the main speaker, but they were there just as kind of a broadening effect for the selective memory process, since this is all oral tradition. What we did was sat in a little jungle villa. I had a video camera, and for between 2 and 3 weeks, we spent every day, all day, just listening to them tell their story. I videotaped everything that was said, and then periodically, about every 4 or 5 minutes, the grandson, who speaks fluent Spanish and Waltadero, no English, would put for me on video what was being said in the native tongue. Then I went back, came back to Michigan, and over the next couple of years, went through 50-some hours of dialogue and put it back into English. So that was the logistical process that we used.
Well, it's interesting, in those early chapters, in Western literature or in Western writing, we are so linear. The stories have beginnings, middles, and endings, where this sort of circles. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit difficult for a modern reader to work their way through the early chapters, just because we're so used to our own story structure, which this doesn't quite follow.
Does rarely follow. You're exactly,
rarely follows.
You're exactly right. And it was difficult for me as well, because I'm an outsider, a Kauri, as they would say. I mean, I'm a tribal member now, but their focus is so much on, you know, from event to event.
Yes.
And as that circles, you know, if there's repetition, you know, they will use those events even to teach their children through their mythology, through their history, you know, lessons of life that will help them to be good Waorani warriors, as the case may be, or housewives. But as he tells the story, he would kind of jump around, but he would try to make a point, you know, not just chronologically, but to tell about the ancient traditions, you know, their ancestors, but they would jump around thematically too, talking about death, talking about the afterlife, talking about teaching their children. But he did eventually work through all that history in kind of a circular fashion, I think you could say even chronologically, to what kind of the pivotal points were when they had contact with the outside world, they speared the missionaries to death, and now the last part of the book, as you recall, was what his vision is for his people.
Now, in those early chapters, in the first half of the book, we're talking about hunting and gathering and killing. Mm-hmm. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, hunting and gathering, obviously, for survival. Killing just was a way of life. Some of that has to do with the kinship system. There were, back then and still to some degree, is the tradition of arranged marriages. It was not so much falling in love with someone you wanted to marry, but parents would decide whose son would marry whose daughter. But sometimes there was a reaction to that, in which there was someone who did have somebody specifically in mind, so they would kill off the rival's family, uncles, aunts, cousins. And the kinship is very, very important to them, very complex. And so it just got to be very rampant. But Moipa becomes a central figure, as you recall, in that first half of the book. And he had just determined that killing for him was a way of eliminating any rival suitors as a leader. And as the kinship system developed, he just wanted to basically own the tribe. Eventually, and you see this later in the book, the tribe divides into two factions, which are considered the upriver and the downriver faction. The downriver are the Tarumanari, Tageri, and the upriver are just, they consider themselves Waorani, but they're the ones that have had contact and are contacted by the outside world. There's currently a war that is going on there, started last year in March, because of this. The downriver people who are in voluntary isolation still and don't even have contact with the upriver people, anybody who comes in or tries to cross their territory, whether they're colonists or the neighboring Quechuas, will never make it out alive. No one has really survived those contacts. But they tried to come upriver and say, look, we want to eliminate these outside influences. And by that, they mean the oil companies, the helicopters flying in and out, you know, just all those things of the modern world that they don't want to have any part of. It's really a war that's going on between the two factions, and hundreds of women, children have been killed recently.
Could we go back to Mankali? Is that
Minkai?
You have something in the book, a description that really shows his skill as a hunter.
Okay, the one that I'm going to read actually is about Moipa. He is the one who is known as the expert warrior. And Minkai is telling this from his perspective, okay, still as a child, of Moipa, the one to be feared. He was resident not only in everybody's conversations during the day, but their dreams at night, just out of abject fear. I'm just going to read a couple of pages here. Moipa, expert that he was, knew the Warani techniques in fleeing, and as he persisted in his stalking, he's going after someone, obviously, eventually caught up with the dying man. When he finally saw this moving spear protruding from the water, he fell upon his victim and took his life as he struggled in an effort to stay hidden. At that point, Moipa should have fled the scene and left the area. When Kemo's sister Konta heard that her brother had been killed and knew that she and her family were in danger, she devised a strategy of her own. One evening, when Moipa was close by her village, she picked up a burning ember from one of the fires and offered to accompany him into the jungle so that she could light his way. But everyone knew better than that. The last thing Moipa needed was a lantern to guide him on the jungle paths at night. Legend had it that he could see even when it was pitch black and was known as the supreme expert in the ways of the jungle. Even the Quechua and other people groups from the outside, whom we call Kowotis, literally non-human cannibals, knew how to use the river to disguise their path and erase their footprints. But Moipa had devised means to disguise or erase his footprints in other ways even while he walked the jungle trails. He would cut a vine, the tropical liana which grow up and around the trunk of a tree, to fasten large leaves to his feet and soften the imprint of his body weight through the soles of his feet. He was also known for his ability to submerge his body in the river and cover his body with natural smells so that even the dogs, who were no longer able to pick up a scent on his trail. Dogs were at that point not a Warani thing. They were agents of security from the Quechuas, but known because of that. The Quechuas had also learned this technique, but could never fool Moipa. When he would lose a fugitive's trail, he would immediately look to see whether the vines had been cut. Once he had located the evidence, he could follow his victim's trail as though he were leaving clear footprints. "You see," he would say, "here's where they cut the vine, and here's where they climbed the bank. After them." And there was no escape. So Moipa was known throughout the land as a fierce warrior with unmatchable strategy and ability, and was simply unstoppable. There was nothing that escaped his attention. There was no strategy that he could not outdo. He seemed to be able to read your mind and know everything about you. In every situation, he knew exactly what to do, where to attack and when, and every move he had to make to assure that not one person would be able to escape his clutches alive. It was as though he could imagine in detail every event and every happening before his attack and carry it out precisely the way he wished it to be.
When you get to the middle of the book, the story begins to change, mm-hmm. and it begins to change when the five missionaries are killed. Then I believe it's a Roman Catholic priest is killed later.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then there's suddenly a new understanding. Can you talk about how that happens?
Well, in their oral history, there had been a lot of teaching, mythologies about, you know, the order of the universe, the existence of some kind of creator in a very general sense. When these missionaries attempted to come in and were speared, to back up a little bit chronologically, there had been a young woman by the name of Dayuma, who, because of the general fear of the people of Moipa and people like him who were just killing off their own people at about a 60% rate per year, she had decided to actually go and give herself to the Quechuas in hope that she would find some security and escape from this horrible, bloody life that they were living. During the time she was outside, she came in touch with these missionaries who eventually would come back into the jungle to try to contact these people, and taught these missionaries some of the Wautadedu language. She, by this time, had learned some Quechua. And so eventually she came back into the tribe, and this was after the five men had been killed. So there was a period of years where she was outside. during that time, she had met the sister of one of the men who was killed, and the wife of another. So when she came back in, she had been missing for all these years. So there was a lot of mutual mistrust. She was coming back into a land that she had left for security, but the purpose was she was kind of a liaison for these two women that wanted to contact the Warani on a level of changing their lifestyle. So it was just specific teaching that, you know, the missionaries and specifically Dayuma tried to bring to the people about the nonsense or the counterproductiveness of killing each other, which had just up until then seemed to be such a way of life. There is a point in the book where they each describe a day where they sat, the three co-authors of the book sat down and talked about this concept of a creator God or someone who had principles of life that he stood for or, chose for us to live by. And they each, on the same day, without having planned it, went to talk to this missionary about their desire to live a good life, as they would say, and to put away the spears. That's been a very small amount of the people in the tribe who have given up that lifestyle. They are definitely the minority. There's still a lot of killing. I've been in the tribe when there have been killings. And as I mentioned, this war that's just come up between the two factions of the tribe, it doesn't seem to be getting any better. A lot of it's now politically oriented as well.
But you suggest in the text that when the people learned that they could live a different kind of way, some people gravitated to that very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And Minkai and the two others, Kamuandui, were three of them. They became very involved on a humanitarian level of trying to actually contact the people that were still isolated from them. And there were a lot of kinship ties there. Even though there was no direct contact and they didn't want any direct contact, the Tarumanari, there were kinship ties that allowed some of them to go in and attempt to make that contact. There's a village by the name of Tonyampare, which is named after a young man who was a young child by the time the missionaries came and just had an avid interest in becoming fluent in Spanish, in becoming a teacher, but he also wanted to learn the white man's scriptures. Mm-hmm. And his passion later on became to make contact with the downriver people and make them see that there was a better way of life. And as you read in the book, he was eventually speared to death by those people. He figured that he probably would be, but he felt very much on a mission that he felt that he was sent by Creator God, Wengongi, as they call him, to go and make contact with these people. And he was the first Warani martyr.
In Native cultures, the warrior is very important, and it plays a part in your book as well.
Yes. Even as a child, Minkai describes the aftermath of a killing or of a massacre when the warriors would come back to the village and grab the children and just beat the tar out of them, so to speak. And that was a way of inculcating in them as well this warrior mentality. They felt as though they were being punished for someone else being massacred, but it was really a way to say, you need to become warrior-like as well. Back in those days, they wore virtually no clothing. The men would have a band around their waist, the women as well. And so they never considered themselves naked, but they were certainly unclothed. But what clothing they did wear or what adornment they wore was particularly focused on that. For the men, I am a warrior. The crowns that they would wear of toucan feathers and other colorful feathers. They have a black dye that's they make tattoos with. It's called huito. They tattoo their arms with specific symbols that relate to their being warriors as well. But there's also a dignity even in killing. There are places that I'm sure you recall where when they would kill someone, they would try to catch them under their armpit as a mercy killing. And when they killed somebody, they wanted to make it go quickly. Or if they had injured someone, someone else would come behind them and finish them off in mercy. It was bloody. It was almost inconceivable. As I was writing the book, I had nightmares at night just living through this. But there's a passage in the book that I think might be helpful to read, even to tell how a warrior wanted to die. Is that appropriate at this point?
Oh, absolutely.
This is about Ninkiwi. He was actually the man that was on the beach when the missionaries made their first contact by plane on the beach of the Kurarai River. That's a separate story in itself, but he wanted another wife, and the first people that the missionaries saw was this Ninkiwi and Gimari, and that became kind of part of the misunderstanding that caused them to kill them. The missionaries also had a picture of Dayuma, which they thought was going to be kind of their inroad with these people to let them see that they were friends. But they interpreted it as a two-dimensional carving of Dayuma's spirit. So it just went the opposite way. They were sure they were cannibals. So Ninkiwi had kind of a troubled place even in his own tribe, because of he was considered a warrior, but when he tried to take this woman, when he already had another couple of wives, it just kind of got complicated. But I want to focus for a second in this script on his death and what kind of death he wanted to die. When the sun came up, Ompore went with some other women to visit Ninkiwi. He had already been speared by some of his own people just because of, even by their own standards of ethics and morality, that he had violated. I didn't go with him. This is Menkai talking. When Ompore saw Ninkiwi, she didn't think he had been speared because she couldn't see the spears. They had been cut off close to his abdomen. But upon closer inspection, she saw the wounds on both sides of his stomach and on both sides of his back, where parts of the spears still lay embedded. During the time he had been running, the movement of the long spears had caused extensive damage to his organs, including his liver and kidneys. "Where's Menkai?" He turned to Ompore when she came near. "He stayed in my village," she answered. Ompore is Menkai's last wife. "Why didn't he come? And who did this?" He winced in pain. "This was not my husband who did this to you. Your own brother Nimonka and your brother-in-law Jui came to do this because you have always threatened them. That is the reason for this. I should never have done that, for I could have continued living. This hurts me more than the injury, but I know that I no longer have the hope to stay alive. I want all of you to dig my grave and put me into it. When I am lying down, I want you to cover me over while I am still awake, and I will die after the earth has covered me." Together they dug the hole for Ninkiwi. On the bottom of the grave, they spread wita, which is like a tree bark that falls off the tree, before placing him in the grave. Before they began to throw the dirt over him, he spoke. "My son Tementa is only a child and must grow up to provide for you, Epa," his wife. "But I have loved Menkere even more than my two sons. I ask you to lay her on my chest here in my grave, but do not kill her. Let us be together while we are still alive, and then you must cover us both with the earth. We will go together. I will grant you your request," Epa stoically answered him. But the other women protested. "How can you allow your daughter to die like that?" They gasped in awe. "It is a tradition of our people," Epa affirmed. "He has asked for her to go with him, and I will give him what he requests of me." "My daughter must die with me," Ninkiwi repeated. "Bring Menkere to me." But when the little girl heard what was happening, she ran away into the jungle. When they told him that she had fled, he asked, "Where is my youngest daughter then, Yeko?" "She is here beside me," Epa said, with the youngest girl behind her. Her age was about the number of fingers on one hand plus two on the other, because she was tall enough to be above the waist of an adult. So Epa took the hammock with the rope used to tie it to the post and threw that rope up over the branch of a tree. She put the rope around the neck of the child and pulled her feet up off the ground. She kept her this way for a couple of minutes and then let her fall, but she did not die because she grabbed onto the rope and attempted to support her weight. "Put her into the grave with me now," Ninkiwi said weakly. But she climbed into the hole on her own. She lay down on her father's chest, and he hugged her. He also wrapped his legs around her body so she could not rise back up out of the grave when the earth was thrown back over them. It was time to bury them. Everyone who was there began to throw dirt over them, leaving their heads uncovered until last. But when the dirt began to fall on their faces, he called out, "Get me out of this grave! Don't bury me or my daughter!" But he had instructed us when we were digging the grave not to pay attention to him if he asked to change his mind. "It is not possible for me to survive these wounds," he had told us. "I will not live through this. When I tell you to let me go, do not pay attention to my plea. Keep burying me." So we kept right on filling in the gaping hole. That is when we could clearly hear the desperate attempts of both father and daughter to stay alive, fighting for air. "Yeko," cried pitifully as the earth built up over her little body. In a short time, they both lay under the ground, dead.
Tim Paulson reading from Gentle Savage, Still Seeking the End of the Spear. About what, in terms of years, about what time did that story happen?
That would have been in the early 60s. The event in which the missionaries were killed was January 7th on 1956. And so this was just a few years after that.
So your book starts before that time, but the legends go way back. Mm-hmm. And then we come up to the present. They were people who lived in a very remote area, but now the modern world is quickly encroaching on that. How was that working out for the Native people?
Aaron, I would say that's probably the focus for the author, Minkai, of why he wanted to get this book in print. The jungle life is as it always was, even thousands of years ago. They're ingenious people. They have developed spears that are very effective in specifically designed for bloodletting, quick death. They've developed blowguns and with not a poison, but an agent on the end of the dart that neutralizes the nerves of the monkey. It doesn't poison the meat if they choose to eat the monkey, and it eventually wears off so that if they want to take the pet home or take the monkey home as a pet, it becomes a normal animal again, but it causes them to lose their grip in the tree. They've developed barbasco, which causes fish to temporarily go to sleep. Doesn't poison the meat or anything, but you can catch 600 pounds of catfish in just a few minutes from a dugout canoe and a spear. So they're very intelligent people. One of the focuses for Minkai is for his young people to return to the ancient ways. They want them to learn to carve a dugout canoe, for them to make hammocks and purses out of the palm fronds that they make string from. But the modern world is now so close, and by close I mean 100 miles away. For a Waurani youth in good shape, and they all are, that's a 3-day trip. They know the trails from the ancient world to the modern world. The closest point is a little village called Puyo, but there are all the amenities of modern life. So as the youth experiment or explore in leaving the jungle to go to the village, many times they just get lost in the attractions, the possibility of a better life. They see men and women and young people dressed in flashy clothing, going to the theater. I just want to tell you quickly about one event of watching that happen. I was in the jungle with a group of people that I had taken down, and some of the young people left the jungle to go to the village. A week or so later, I specifically remember one young girl who was probably 16. When she left, she was virtually naked, very scantily clothed in a sense that it was just functional for them as a people. When she came back, she had on some modern clothing. She was actually wearing more clothing than when she left, but the focus was sensuality. It was a short skirt. It was a kind of a halter top, and she had makeup on, but it looked totally ridiculous in that setting, mm-hmm. because it was not at all natural. But it was just one of those things that kind of demonstrates what the youth go through even in their identity, when they go to the modern world. They're typically looked upon as second-rate citizens at the best, more like something somewhat subhuman. Mm-hmm. So Minkai's focus is to instill in the youth a sense of identity, knowledge of their old traditions, but also if they do leave the tribe, and it's inevitable that many will, he wants them to be prepared to function in a modern world. His grandson, we brought him up to Michigan 4 years ago because the elders of the tribe wanted him to learn to become a commercial pilot. I received a lot of criticism for doing that because the sense was typically he's a jungle Indian. How is he going to learn something as technical as commercial aviation? But he is now a private pilot. He has got his mechanics license, and he's working on his commercial rating, his IFR rating, and doing very well. They're very intelligent people. But in general, to answer your question, I think it's the focus on the young people and their sense of identity, but also a key word throughout the last part of the book is interdependency. He's very keen on the fact that they have needs from us, the modern city dwellers, but we really need to pick up from their perspective too of how they live close to nature, how they use herbs and medicines that are natural. They have no cases of cancer among them as a tribe, typically very healthy, but they also have dental needs. So there's just kind of a give and take in his mind of the need for us to work interdependently.
Your website has some really interesting pictures of these people who look very healthy.
Yeah, sure. They're expert herbologists. They have a very, what I consider to be a well-rounded diet. They eat a lot of fruits, fish, some wild game. Speaking of the website, if it's okay to mention that, that's
yes.
www.gentlesavage.org. And there are also even some links on the website where you can get on YouTube and see how we produced the book. You're asking early on how we brought this out logistically. It shows them sitting with me with the video cameras and how it goes through the three languages from Altadero through Spanish to English. But also the celebration later after the book was published, in which we went back to the jungle, focused on Minkai, Kimwenjui, and presenting them their own copies of the book.
Yeah, I was curious about that. Here's a group of people who have no written history, and then you bring them, it is in fact their history that you bring back to them. What was the reaction to that?
It was varied, but in general, I would say, the young people, by and large, are hungry to know those ancient traditions. It's easy for that to slip away because the government, the Ecuadorian government, from shortly after this event happened in the 50s, brought in teachers from the outside to try to nationalize the people, even linguistically. They began to teach their school from elementary on up through high school in Spanish. So that required not only for the youth to learn Spanish as a second language, but kind of has replaced not only Waltadedo as their primary language, but just washed away that sense of the ancient traditions, the mythology, the skills that they were learning before. But we want to put the book back into Spanish. I'm working on that right now so that the young people and people throughout Latin America will be able to read this story as well in Spanish, because for someone, say, from Ecuador, these are their own compatriots. They live in the same country. A lot is known about them. You hear about it in the news every day, this war that's going on right now, what's going on with the government, what's going on with the oil companies, and just all the natural resources, those issues that are in balance.
So if listeners want to get a copy of this book, how can they go about it? Where will they find this?
If you get on the website, www.gentlesavage.org, there is a page there that allows you to order the book through a PayPal account, or you can contact me personally, but all the information is on the website.
Nice looking website, too.
Thank you. Thank you, Aaron.
So, Tim Paulson, thank you for being here. Thank you for sharing Gentle Savage, Still Seeking the End of a Spear.
Thank you for having me, Aaron. It's really been a pleasure.
You're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. I'd like to welcome Peter Marable back to Michigan Writers on the Air. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks, Aaron. Good to be here.
In 2013, Peter published his first mystery novel, More Than a Body. It's a book set in Chicago and Paris. This summer, he has a new book out, Murder at Cherokee Point. And this book is set where?
Well, it's set primarily in Petoskey, Michigan, and on Mackinac Island, Michigan, about 50-50.
And there's also a mythical summer colony.
There is indeed a summer colony or summer resort association, as I call it, Cherokee Point, which I also mythically place somewhere north of Harbor Springs on the Lake Michigan shoreline.
So you've come to writing after a number of careers. Most notably, you started as an academic. You taught at Michigan State.
I did. I spent 25 years on the faculty at MMSU teaching history, politics, and writing for a good number of years, yes.
And then you took your life a very different direction.
A very different direction that along with my business partner and spouse, Frances Barger, we own two businesses on Mackinac Island. Well, so it comes as no surprise that Mackinac is a wonderful place to set a mystery novel.
So your first book, and you told me this last year, your first book took 20 years.
The book took 20 years before I could sit here and you could say just published his first novel. It was actually written in about a year in 1993, but it was shortly after that Fran and I started our first business on the island. And once that started, between our teaching careers and our careers as retailers up north, there was no time to even think about writing.
But you then eventually came back to it?
I came back to it, and I came back to it precisely because of the Mystery Writers Workshop at Interlaken. I signed up for that first one in 2012. That gave me a real kick in the pants to think that I could possibly play with it for a while, get it right, and get it published. And that's exactly what happened. If I hadn't come here, it would not have happened, and neither would the one that we're sitting here talking about today.
So the new book is much larger, a much more complicated plot. Could you give our listeners a sense of what happens in the story without giving it all away?
Oh, I don't want to give it all away. That'd be no fun. Yes, there is this resort association called Cherokee Point. It's a very sort of upscale, very private, very privileged, very secretive kind of place. And one of its members gets dead one night. The cops and the prosecutor, mythically made up for Emmett County, have no luck because the members try to stonewall. And they ask their friend, and colleague in court at least, local attorney Michael Russo, who is the protagonist, if he can kind of act as a buffer to get some of the folks to help them, meaning the cops, with the investigation so that they can get their job done.
Because the people in the colony are not particularly cooperative.
They're not particularly cooperative. They see every sort of inquiry, even that of a reasonably normal, from the point of view of the prosecutor, murder investigation, as an intrusion into their private lives. They don't see it as a murder investigation. They don't see it as cops and prosecutors having a job to do.
And we have members of Congress, members of state legislatures, and people of enormous wealth who bring a lot of pressure.
We do, and they bring a lot of pressure at the drop of a hat. So somebody makes a phone call and a prosecutor gets another phone call from a senator, from a member of Congress, even a former governor.
But these are set up north, but the characters come from a variety of places, and we even have members of organized crime.
Yeah, I have a great deal of fun with organized crime. I'm sort of a fan of The Godfather and the Mafia. So I'm going to throw one in whenever I can. And yes, there is a retired Mafia Don who buys a mythical hotel on Mackinac Island and renovates it and runs it as a legitimate business. And then there's his name is Carmen DeMio. And his son, Joey DeMio, ultimately is taking over the family business, which includes the hotel on the island.
So would you like to read some for our listeners?
Sure. I'll do a small section with a little bit of action to it. The setup for this is that our hero, Michael Russo, has gone to Mackinac Island because he soon will have an appointment with Mafia Don Carmen DeMio. The night before, he decides to wander around the island, a place he loves to visit on a regular basis, and he is on Main Street and headed to get something to eat. I walk down Main Street to Astor Street and turn the corner. I walked across the street to the Mustang Bar. I took a stool at the bar. "What can I get you?" said the bartender, a guy with a buzz cut and wire-rimmed glasses. He looked too young to be in a bar, let alone work in one. "A draft, please," I said, "and a menu." "You got it," he said, pointing his finger pistol-style my way. A coaster, the beer, and a menu landed in front of me. "Holler when you're ready to order." "Will do," I said, pointing my pistol finger back at him. The beer tasted good. Over one corner of the bar, a TV played ESPN, soccer. I enjoyed the beer more. I gave serious thought to ordering another one when a guy sat down next to me and almost knocked me off my stool. I looked to my right. His face, big, round, puffy, with a red nose, stared straight at me. "Sorry, pal," he said, dragging out the word pal. Before I could say anything, I got pushed hard from the other side into Mr. Rednose on my right. "Hey, watch out," he said, and shoved me back into the new guy on my left. "Well, excuse me, buddy," Mr. Lefty said. He was just as tall as the other man, but with a chiseled face, dark skin, and a small goatee. Being the crack investigator that I am, I concluded that the arrival of these two guys was no coincidence. "Lot of rude people in the world, ain't that right, Gino?" It was Mr. Lefty. "Yeah," Mr. Rednose said. "What do you got to do to get a beer around here?" The bartender, so punctual in my case, was nowhere in sight. Another coincidence? "Beats me, Mr. Lefty," I was being squeezed hard between two of them. My pleasant evening was already taking a decidedly sour turn. "Gentlemen," I said, as friendly as I could, "I'd be glad to swap stools so that you two can continue your conversation." "Well, damn, Santino," Mr. Rednose said. "Can you beat this guy? Try to be nice, and what do you get? Maybe we ought to teach him..." Caught it out of the corner of my eye. Something moved, fast. Mr. Rednose never finished his sentence. He was on the floor, looking every bit like a beached whale, staring up at the man standing next to me. The man was 6'3", a trained 230, the muscles in his chest and arms barely concealed by a navy T-shirt. He wore baggy gray shorts and dirty Brooks running shoes. "Terribly sorry, sir," he said. "May I help you up?" No one in the bar moved. Mr. Lefty, Santino, came off his stool. He'd taken only one step when the stranger spun around and put his arm out straight, palm up, traffic cop style. Santino froze. The hand in the air turned into a finger pistol. The stranger's finger slowly turned and pointed at the door. Santino's eyes followed, so did mine. Leaning against the wall was a Mackinac Island police officer, blue uniform with his arms crossed over his chest, and armed. "Officer Concannon," the stranger said, "don't you think it's a shame this man can't enjoy his beer in peace and quiet?" And that's that.
So two books in 2 years, you work in the tourist industry a big part of the year, or probably half the year.
Yeah.
You're working 7 days a week.
Doors are open 7 days a week from May to October, yes.
What's your process? How did you get this done?
Well, I started the Murder at Cherokee Point, playing around with it a year ago winter, trying to figure out what I wanted to do, trying to figure out the characters, trying to figure out the place, although I knew I wanted it to be Petoskey and Mackinac Island. And then I just started writing in those last few days and weeks I had left before we really geared up to work on Mackinac in the spring 2013. I brought with me what I had written when I came to the workshop again in 2013 at Interlaken. And I actually used some of my own characters and some of my own scenes for exercises that we did in class. And that helped me kind of move it along at very much the time it would normally not move along very quickly. The rest of the summer and into the fall, again, we worked very hard, long hours. I tried to do some writing every day. Usually it was very early in the morning. Sometimes I wrote on my day off, so I really didn't get a day off if you between working in the, on the island and working on the writing. But I tried to do something to keep it moving along as much as I could throughout the summer. And by the time we got to the late fall, then I could start to write maybe a half a day every day and then do some editing. So by Christmas time, it was ready to go to an editor.
And then the process from that is fairly quick.
Well, it was fortunately it was, because my editor thought that what I'd done was pretty good, and her comments were helpful, and my changes tended to be pretty minimal, mostly for clarity or getting rid of something that seemed extraneous. So I was able to get it up and ready for her to publish by the end of this spring, 14.
I'm talking with Peter Marable. We're talking about his new crime book, Murder at Cherokee Point. So at this time, where is the book available? It's in some of the local stores?
Yes, it's certainly available in Traverse City at Horizon on Front Street and Brilliant Books on Front Street. And it's, of course, available at the Island Bookstore, both on Mackinac Island and in Mackinac City. And for those folks who want an electronic edition, it's on Amazon along with the paper edition.
Peter Marable, author of Murder at Cherokee Point, thank you for being here.
Oh, you're very welcome, Aaron. Good to be here.
Fleta Brown is here. Welcome, Fleta.
Hi, Aaron. I'm glad to be here. I've read a lot of poems and books by the prolific poet William Stafford, but this one I want to talk about today that's just come out from the University of Pittsburgh Press is incredibly interesting to me. It's called Sound of the Axe, Aphorisms and Poems. Stafford died in 1993, and this book is a collection edited by Vincent Wickson and Paul Merchant. Stafford takes the axe to language in this collection. There are only 26 poems, the rest are aphorisms, brief sayings which Stafford defined as a metaphor in work clothes, the kind of statement that delivers groceries. Aphorism literally means a distinction or definition. The sense of an aphorism is really subjective, but we recognize its validity. James Dickey called Stafford a real poet, a born poet, whose natural mode of speech is a gentle, mystical, half-mocking and highly personal daydreaming about the Western United States. Now let me read you some of the aphorisms. Stafford collected these for years and years. This collection contains almost 400 of the 1,000 that show up regularly in Stafford's 50 years of daily writing. He liked to make these up, or as he said, discover them. The root and the flower have to trust each other. We are a school of fish in a lake. Nobody signals, but when we all begin to turn, everybody adjusts. We think the world is the shape of our lake. Trouble with explaining about poetry. The words are always carrying on a clandestine affair with each other and implicating the thought. So a sentence won't drain away. You put a period at the end of it. That's one of my favorites.
That is very good.
Truth has no perspective. Once you learn to trust your sensation of being lost, you are found. The other end of the compass needle is just as reliable as the north end. Many things we think are leaving are waiting for us. Sinner that I am, couldn't I cast just a little stone? Poetry is the kind of thing you have to see from the corner of your eye. You can be too well prepared for poetry. A conscientious interest in it is worse than no interest at all. If you analyze it away, it's gone. It would be like boiling a watch to find out what makes it tick. Okay, but what about the poems in this collection? Actually, I think you may feel that you've been hearing poems in each one of those lines that I just read you, and the poems will do the same thing for us. They make us feel like they're aphorisms. These particular poems do. Here's an example of one, and it's very important to keep the title in mind as you hear this one. It's called Sayings of the Blind. Feeling is believing. Mountains don't exist, but their slopes do. Little people have low voices. All things, even the rocks, make a little noise. The silence back of all sound is called the sky. There's a big stranger in town called the sun. He doesn't speak to us, but puts out a hand. Night opens a door into a cellar. You can smell it coming. On Sundays, everyone stands farther apart. Velvet feels black. Meeting cement is never easy. What do they mean when they say night is gloomy? Edison didn't invent much. Whenever you wake up, it's morning. Names have a flavor. So every single line there feels just perfect to me. From the point of view of the blind, every line sort of does its own thing and it turns your mind back on itself to consider. Okay, here's another one, and this one is called Artist Come Home. Remember how bright it is, the old rabbit bush by the hall light? One of the blackberry vines has reached all the way to the clothesline. There isn't any way to keep the kitchen window from tapping. The tea kettle had one of its meditative spells yesterday. I am thinking again of that old plan, breakfast first, then the newspaper. They say maybe they won't have that big war this year after all. A frog is living under the back step. This is a lesson for poets, really, I think, to return home to the source of our poetry, to the concrete objects, that frog under the back steps. Like the poet, he knows where he needs to be, a little hidden that way. Okay, here's another poem called The Dream of Now. This one feels very Stafford-like somehow in that you can't quite get hold of it, but you know it's true. The dream of now. When you wake to the dream of now from night and its other dream, you carry day out of the dark like a flame. When spring comes north and flowers unfold from earth and its even sleep, you lift summer on with your breath, lest it be lost ever so deep. Your life you live by the light you find and follow it on as well as you can, carrying through darkness wherever you go your one little fire that will start again. The human life I hear in that poem is also the life of the planet, waking and sleeping, coming to life and dying back. There we are with our small light that when it goes out will start up again in some way not explained in the poem. We just follow our light, not knowing that. I don't know if you heard it as I read, but this poem is in quatrains. It's in four-line stanzas, and the second and fourth lines rhyme or half-rhyme. There's that kind of song quality that maybe you didn't recognize it, but you can hear that there's something singing about it. Some of the aphorisms, back to those for a minute. Some of the aphorisms you get the feeling just spring from a mood, like these. Do you get writer's block? No, but maybe I should. And on El Greco's forehead, I set my coffee cup and thought of the great and their use to us. And be careful when someone suddenly becomes a lot nicer than you are. I don't think I can end this discussion of this posthumous book by Stafford without bringing back into the light the poem he's most well known for, the title poem of his 1963 National Book Award winning title, Traveling Through the Dark. I think you can hear in it some of the same obsessions, the rich, deep thinking about things, Traveling Through the Dark. Traveling through the dark, I found a deer dead on the edge of the Wilson River Road. It is usually best to roll them into the canyon. That road is narrow. To swerve might make more dead. By glow of the taillight, I stumbled back of the car and stood by the heap, a doe, a recent killing. She had stiffened already, almost cold. I dragged her off. She was large in the belly. My fingers touching her side brought me the reason. Her side was warm. Her fawn lay there waiting, alive, still, never to be born. Beside that mountain road, I hesitated. The car aimed ahead its lowered parking lights. Under the hood purred the steady engine. I stood in the glare of the warm exhaust turning red. Around our group, I could hear the wilderness listen. I thought hard for us all, my only swerving, then pushed her over the edge into the river. Wow. The poet is William Stafford, and the book I highlight today is Sound of the Axe, Aphorisms and Poems from the University of Pittsburgh Press.
Thank you, Fleta. Thank you for listening to Michigan Writers on the Air. I'm grateful to Peter Marable, Tim Paulson, and Fleta Brown. Also, kudos to Brock Moorman and Peter Payette for their skillful engineering and production work on this show. This program is a production of Interlochen Public Radio. Be sure to listen next month to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. Until then, I wish you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words.